Familiarity breeds contempt. It's an idea that we all probably have familiar with. The idea goes back a long way, including mentioned by St. Augustine in the 5th century, although it was Chaucer who wrote it down in his Tale of Melibee that modernized it and put it into our English language. It's the idea that prolonged exposure to something leads to decreased respect or affection for something. In other words, it's the tendency to become less enamored with something or more critical of things the more we get to know them, the more familiar they are to us. Of course, as we've seen with some of the phrases like this, especially when we talked about Proverbs here last year, when I talked to many Proverbs, some of these old Proverbs or old sayings are always given a twist by other people, okay? And so I found some of these. As I was looking up this graphic here, I found other things that talk about familiarity breeds contempt. And here's one by... I don't know the guy, but Neil Coward said this. Says, familiarity breeds contempt, but without a little familiarity, it's impossible to breed anything. So, which of course led to another famous person, Mark Twain, says, familiarity breeds contempt and children. So, that's what familiarity breeds. And of course, if you think about breeding and familiarity, well, then you just have to come up with this graphic here like this. Familiarity just breeds, and it's... I'm getting off track there, but more to the point that when you're familiar with something or someone, the more you take them for granted and treat with less and less respect. And we see this all around us. I mean, you hear all the time about people who've been on the job for a long time, for 10, 20 years, suddenly quitting because, I'm just sick of this job. How can you be sick of a job that you've been at for 10, 20 years? I mean, in marriage, sometimes people get divorced after many, many years of marriage because they're just, the magic's not there anymore. Of course, I always tell people, hey, if you need magic in a marriage, you need to put magic in the marriage. And so that's why have this familiarity, that kind of spontaneity you need to add to it to make it fresh. And so if we're not careful, also, familiarity can breed contempt in our own spiritual lives as well. I mean, you've heard of all kinds of, that people who've been Christians for a long time, they're just not excited as much as newborn Christians and spreading their faith and sharing Christ with people. The more you're familiar with walking Jesus, you just don't feel that same love or that same attitude and passion that you once had at first. And I think this is what Jesus was talking about when he talked in the book of Revelation to the church of Ephesus, saying you lost your first love. It's kind of, you've gotten too familiar with me. Kind of freshen me up. Kind of make me, get to know me better. Get to know me in a different way. And we'll see a little bit about this in our Bible reading today. Because we've been looking at the Gospel of John and how John takes a different approach to the life of Jesus. John knew the other three Gospels, probably, and he just wanted to take a little different approach and say, hey, I'm going to take look at Jesus in a little different light, in a little bit different way. And so he does things different from the other Gospels. And he's the only one that uses words and phrases that the other Gospels do not. In John's writing, we saw that Jesus is called the Word made flesh. That John is the only one that calls Jesus the Lamb of God. John is the only one that tells us of the times when people said, hey, come and see, like Nathaniel. Philip to Nathaniel say, come and see. John is the only one that had Jesus' first miracle of changing water to wine. That's the only gospel that has this. John is the only one that puts the temple cleansing at the beginning in order to emphasize this idea of Jesus wanting to cleanse us from our sins, cleanse our own temples. John is the one that mentions Jesus as being the only begotten Son that we looked at in chapter 3. And John's the only one that we looked at last week about this woman at the well, giving living water that Jesus not only brought to her, but to that entire community there in Samaria. Well, this morning we're going to take a look at two miracles that John mentions next in his gospel that he records. And these two are only mentioned in John's gospel. Kind of interesting as well. Two miracles that are unique to John. And they're two healing miracles that we'll see in a minute. Because a vast majority of Jesus' miracles, if you would list them all out there, and in one of my Bible passages, study Bible things, it does list them all out there. There's like 20 or 35 miracles that Jesus does. About 20 of those are healing miracles. Raising the lame, giving sight to the blind, giving hearing to the deaf. And so it's a vast majority of healing miracles. And John picks three healing miracles of Jesus and puts two of them here in this gospel. And then elsewhere in chapter 9, we'll look at the man born blind in chapter 9. But here, we'll see it. These two miracles have something in common. And I think the common the denominator in these two stories of healing is the faith that we see behind the people. And I think this is why he connects them two together, even though he performs them miles apart. John connects them in his gospel, and actually, when he wrote the gospels, didn't have chapter divisions, so there really is no chapter divisions when John writes. He's saying, hey, there's one miracle, here's another miracle, and I think they have the same connection and the same thing, as we'll see this morning. Because, like all of John's miracles, he calls them signs that point to Jesus. Not miracles, because he was not focused on the miraculous, the magical things of Jesus, the supernatural things. He wanted to point to who Jesus was, that there's a person behind Jesus, and what he came, who he is, and what he came to do. Because Jesus was more than a miracle worker. He was, as we'll see this morning, a healer. Someone that we can put our faith in, who can heal us, not just physically, but also spiritually as well. So let's take a look at these two healing miracles and see how they point to Jesus. Now, the first miracle of Jesus the healer is a healing at a distance kind of miracle. The first sign that starts these closing chapters in chapter 4, Jesus heals at a distance. So let me start reading there in chapter 4 of John, starting in verse 43. It says, after 2 days, he left for Galilee. He was in Samaria. He left for Galilee. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. Kind of puts it in parentheses, but that's very important, I think, to John's thinking here. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they had also had been there. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. He begged him to come to heal his son. Jesus says, unless you people see miraculous signs and wonders, you will never believe. The royal official continued saying, sir, come down before my child dies. Jesus replied, you may go, your son will live. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. While he was still on his way, his servants met him with the news that the boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, the fever left him yesterday at the 7th hour. Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. Now notice the context of this sign of Jesus. He had just finished his trip there in Samaria, a very successful trip where many people started believing in Jesus because of Jesus' testimony, because of what Jesus was saying. And if you would recall, Jesus really did not perform any miracles there in Samaria to back up his claim to be Messiah. The only miracle, I guess you could call it, was Jesus knowing the background of this lady, that she was married to 5 men and then was living with another man. That was the only really supernatural thing, that Jesus knew this woman's background, but he didn't really perform any miracles there in Samaria. But then when he gets up to Galilee, which I told you last week was in the northern part of Israel, the first thing they want Jesus to do is start performing miracles again. They start wanting him to be a miracle worker. And I think this is the key, because the only miracle, because Jesus wanted to perform a miracle. And after all, when Jesus was still in Jerusalem, John points out that Jesus did miracles down in Jerusalem, not just the one that we see in that passage there. But they did miracles. And some people get confused when John points to all these signs that Jesus, well, this is the second sign it points to. But if you would notice the final verses there, that he did perform signs there up in Galilee too. But did you notice that the second miracle is actually done in the same town that Jesus performed the miracle of the changing water to wine, in Cana? However, remember when we studied about the water to wine, I only told you that only a handful of people knew about that miracle. Only Jesus, his mother, and a few disciples and servants knew that the miracle actually took place. This was a behind-the-scenes, kind of in-the-shadows kind of miracle. Jesus really didn't perform a lot of miracles in Galilee at first. But as I said, these people in Galilee had also been with Jesus in the Passover when he cleansed the temple. And so it says Sorry, I'm looking at my slide here, and it's the conclusion of the passage that I read about. So let me read the conclusion of the passage here, talking about the man. So he and the man and all his household believe, and this was the second miraculous sign that Jesus performed there, arriving from Judah to Galilee. So, okay, that's the end of the story. But, again, this wasn't Jesus' only two signs, the miracle of changing water to wine and the miracle of the distance healing here. Because back in chapter 2, verse 23, we read this. Now while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many people saw miraculous signs that he was doing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, would not believe all this, for he knew all of men. He did not need man's testimony about man, for he knew what was in a man. So right here, John is saying, Jesus took it, realized that these people were just wanting him for the miracles. They really didn't believe who he was. He didn't really think that these signs that he was performing for them there made them truly believe. And yet, when we read our chapter here this morning, it says that the Galileans believed. But I think it was, again, in this idea that they believed that he was a miracle worker, not really the Messiah. And so Jesus really did not want to continue performing signs up there because they would get the wrong idea. He did not want them to believe that he was just a miraculous worker, but he was actually the Messiah. And so both John and Jesus realized this. This is why at the beginning of the story of John, he puts in parentheses that a prophet is not with honor in his own country. This is where I think that idea that I started with, familiarity breeds contempt, came into play. Because they, up in Galilee, that's where Jesus came from. Jesus grew up in that area. This was near his hometown, and he knew the people still saw him as just a strange little boy whose father was a carpenter. Jesus never claimed to have messianic prophecies or priest up there before this time. But now Jesus was different, and people just couldn't accept this. And so they just wanted him to be kind of, like I said, a miracle worker. And this is kind of ironic because maybe John is pointing to the contrast between Galilee and just the story before with Samaria, because Samaria people believed, didn't take miracles for them to believe. And so John was saying, hey, up in Galilee, Jesus was doing the same thing, not performing miracles, and people just were not believing. They just were not really believing who Jesus was. His own people, the Jews up in Galilee, were totally different from the Samaritans just a few days before. I like that contrast there. And it should be mentioned that all four Gospels mention that Jesus does not receive honor in Galilee, in Nazareth, and in that area up north. Matthew chapter 13, 57 says this. It says, they took offense at him, but Jesus said to them, only in his hometown and in his own house is a prophet without honor. Mark's Gospel, same thing, very similar, probably the same context here. It says, Jesus said to him, only in his own town, among his own relatives, in his own house, is a prophet without honor. All four Gospels. We'll see this in Luke in a minute, and we see it here in John that we read already, that people just didn't believe who Jesus was in his own town. And so it's very difficult for Jesus to perform miracles. In fact, the verse right after this one, and it's verse right after Matthew as well, if you look at Matthew's gospel, but same thing here in Mark chapter 5, or verse 6, chapter 6, verse 5 says, he could not do any miracles there except to lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. He was amazed at their lack of faith. You can see it also, like I said, in Matthew 13. That this lack of faith was the cause behind some of Jesus saying, okay, I just can't do this because you need to have faith in order to be healed. And I think this is crucial to this story here, that John puts this in context by putting that little parenthesis saying, hey, Jesus was not with honor here at this place because they didn't really believe. They welcomed him, but not as a Messiah, but as a magician of sorts. They wanted Jesus to perform. They wanted to see some action, not, oh, hear Jesus teach about God and who he came to be. They didn't welcome him. They didn't believe him. They were only interested in these magicians. They couldn't connect the signs to the person of Jesus. And so Jesus doesn't do anything spectacular up there, including this miracle, notice. Again, this miracle wasn't a public miracle. The only public miracle that John records that Jesus did up in Galilee was the feeding of the 5,000. And he mentions after that, they didn't understand why he fed them. They were still confused about the bread of life. And we'll talk about that when we get to the feeding of the 5,000. That's the only public miracle that... Now, there's other miracles that the other Gospels talk about up there. But it mentions that Jesus couldn't really do a whole lot up there because of their lack of faith. And so this miracle is different than any other Gospels that we read here. You see, John tells us about this miracle of healing this royal official. Now, John tells us this is a royal official, and so this is a well-off person, someone in the royal court of King Herod, and this is kind of the third kind of broad stereotype of person that Jesus ministers to in these last couple chapters, right? We've talked about Nicodemus, he was a top royal, top religious official, a leader in the Sanhedrin, kind of a Jew of Jews, and he, by the way, really didn't believe at the end of it. We talked about just the opposite last week with a woman at the well, a woman, a Samaritan, someone that was not well-liked and all that stuff, and he came to her, someone of low repute, and that represented separate people of a different group, a different type of Jew here, or the Samaritans. But here, John tells us, Jesus is reaching out to this royal official, probably a Roman, not a Jew. Could have been a Jew, but we're not told. But probably a Roman, because those are the people that were high up in the courts of Herod. But someone with wealth, someone with power, someone with a significance, not part of the Jewish people. He too had heard about this miracle worker in the area, and he came to see Jesus. He had a son that was near death, it tells us. We're not told what kind of sickness he had, a fever of some kind. But we're told he continually begged Jesus to come to Capernaum. He was in Cana, about 25 miles away, and he said, "Hey, come and heal my son, please, please." It's a continuing begging, that word there in Greek. "Please come and heal him, please, I beg you, come on." And Jesus essentially tells him, no. Jesus says, all you guys want from me is to perform miracles, and I'm just not going to do it. That's what he says. Hey, he actually says here, let me get to chapter 5 here. He says, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will never, ever believe. You know, you guys are just looking for miracles. I'm not going to do that. I'm not a performing a monkey type of thing. He says, no, I'm not going to do it to this man. But notice what this man does. This man doesn't give up. Even after Jesus says, all you guys want is more miracles, he continues beseeching Jesus. Come on, Jesus, come on, please help my son. Help my son. Please come before my son dies. Now again, as I looked at this miracle, I looked at the other miracles that Jesus did, and I noticed that most of Jesus' miracles that are recorded in the Gospels, 90% of them or so, are performed by Jesus in the presence. People are touched by Jesus. People are healed because Jesus is right there. There's only three that I found that are miracles from a distance. Now, I told you a few weeks ago that when Jesus knew Anyways, when Philip brought his Nathaniel, when Nathaniel came, Jesus said, "I saw you from a distance," type of thing. That was kind of a miracle distance, but only really list of miracles. Most people, only three of them are performed at a distance. This one here in John, performed to a royal official of some kind, probably a non-Jewish person. But it's interesting that the other two are also very similar, that they're to foreigners, people not of Israel. Now, I'm not sure if this is significant or not, but there are similarities between the three of these miracles. The first miracle that Jesus does is in Matthew chapter 8, or also Luke chapter 7 also has this, where a centurion comes to Jesus and he has a slave that is paralyzed, it says there. A slave, so it's different from this official here. But a centurion, a soldier, comes and says, "Hey, Jesus, heal my servant." And Jesus says, okay. But the centurion says, "No, you don't have to come with me. Just speak the word." He had that kind of faith. I'm a soldier. People under me, I speak the word and they do it. I know if you speak the word, it'll be done. Jesus speaks the word and it's done. He emphasizes this centurion saying, "Hey, such faith I haven't seen in Israel." It's kind of one of those kind of stories, this deep faith of this soldier. And Jesus speaks with authority, and it's done from distance. Jesus didn't go to this person and touch him or raise him up by his hand. And Jesus, like I said, commends this servant's faith for his healing. And the other miracle, the second miracle from a distance, is of a daughter of a Canaanite woman. Now, Matthew tells us this in chapter 15, Mark also in Mark 7. And this daughter of this Canaanite woman is demon-possessed. He's up in actually in Tyre and Sidon area. And this woman comes and says, hey, heal my daughter. And this is the story where Jesus says, hey, I've only, as he says in Matthew 15, I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel. It's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. He calls her a dog and says, hey, I don't want anything to do with you because you're a Canaanite woman. And the Canaanite woman with faith says, but even the dogs underneath the table get some of the crumbs of the people, right? Of the children, right? And so Jesus, hey, just give me a few crumbs, Jesus. Again, tremendous faith of this Gentile pagan woman comes to Jesus, and Jesus heals the girl from this demon possession in the distance. So those are the two we have outside of John's gospel. And then this third one from John's gospel is healing from a distance. And all three of them, like I said, are for people that are not Jewish people. They're Canaanites and Romans. But they're healed from a distance. But all of them have the idea of faith in them. The idea of people believe Jesus so much that they trusted Jesus at his word and took him by faith. Well, here Jesus does something very similar. Instead of going to this man's house and touching his son, he just speaks the word. Go, your son will live. And I think that Jesus does this, as he did in the other two cases, for two reasons. One is because he knows that if he goes to this house, the crowd's going to follow him. The crowd of Galileans there. They know they would follow him, and they would get what they wanted. They wanted to see a miracle, and so Jesus would perform a miracle. Doing it this way, Jesus, no one sees this miracle happen, right? It's not until a day later when the guy meets someone from his household that comes and says, hey, your son's okay, you can come on home, that he actually realized, hey, this actually happened. No one around Jesus on that day saw a miracle happen. Jesus performed this at a distance because he knew that even if they saw a miracle, they still wouldn't believe that he was the Messiah. And Jesus wanted to do everything he did was to point to God. And he knew, hey, if I just do a miracle by going to this place and people seeing it, they're not going to believe me. They're not going to give God the glory for this. But I think secondly, I think Jesus did this to test the faith of this official. It was not enough. He did have enough faith to believe that only Jesus could do this, and he traveled this 25 miles to see Jesus. But did he have enough faith to be satisfied when Jesus said, okay, it's done? Would he have enough faith? Would he really trust Jesus and be satisfied if Jesus would not make that 25-mile trip? And Jesus got his answer right in the next verse. It says there in verse 50, the man took Jesus at his word and departed. Simple. Humbleness of faith. I like how the Message points it out here or translates it. It says, the man believed the bare word Jesus spoke and headed home. Took Jesus at his word. Okay, I believe it. I'm done begging with you. He didn't beg anymore. He says, okay. And right away left and went home to take that 25-mile trip. No more need to be said. This man proved he had faith to believe what Jesus said, and he headed home. And I think we can learn a lesson from this healing miracle, because sometimes we just need to take Jesus at his word. Sometimes we just need to believe what God tells us and says, okay, you said it, that's good enough for me. Some of the hardest kind of faith to have, because you seldom see the results right away. You have to wait for some time to come, or you don't know exactly how it's going to turn out, but God says, hey, it's going to turn out, trust me. And we just have to say, okay, it's hard. It's hard because we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the future has in store for us. Even though a miracle happened, we won't know it until later on it materializes. And yet, it appears this man just took Jesus at his word. Have you ever been in that situation? Have you ever been in a time where you feel Jesus answered your prayer, and yet maybe that prayer was to wait and it's coming? Or you... We'll see. Maybe it's a process that we need to go through until that healing comes. I remember when I was told several years ago that I had cancer, it didn't really alarm me. Usually when you hear the word cancer, it just kind of stuns you. But when I first heard that word, I immediately felt Jesus' peace. And I could feel almost right away Jesus saying, it's going to be okay. I'm going to heal you of this. I couldn't explain it. Even my wife panicked a little bit. And I said, it's going to be okay. Now, that didn't mean I was touched right away and cancer was gone. And the next day, the x-rays came. Miracles happen like that. I know they do, but for me, it was not that way. I had to go through treatments, several months of chemo and things. But I knew. I said, okay, Jesus, you said you're going to cure me? I'm not going to panic. I'm not going to worry. Now, there were some times where I did kind of think about that, but for the most part, I took Jesus at his word. And it's faith like that that Jesus saw in this man. And it's that kind of faith that Jesus is looking for us as well. Do you have that kind of faith that trusts Jesus when it seems like it's not going to happen right away? But he says, have faith, trust me. Do you have that kind of faith? I hope that you have that kind of faith and experience that healing that Jesus has. But then there's a second kind of healing that we see in this passage, a second miracle that Jesus does here that John puts together. Again, there's a chapter division here, but I think the chapter division is kind of, might be wrong. There's a division here because of the division of where it happens. This one happened in Jerusalem. The next one will happen in Jerusalem. But Jesus has a selectively healing. Because this time the healer does something different and shows a different sign pointing to Jesus. He's a selective healing of this person. Now, in order to understand this miracle correctly, I think we need to go back to what John said at the last miracle that we just looked at. That John tells us that Jesus is without honor in his hometown. And I told you that four of the Gospels mentioned this concept. I gave you the passage from Matthew. I gave you the passage from Mark. We read the one from John. But I didn't tell you about Luke's Gospel. Because Luke, even though it's the same context, I believe, adds a little few things to what Jesus says that I think changes kind of the light, and I think that changes the light in reference to this story that John adds here. So this is what Luke says. Luke chapter 4, verse 24 says, I tell you the truth, Jesus continued, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. Again, that phrase is right there. Yet he adds this. He says, I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elisha's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine in the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath, in the region of Sidon, a pagan woman. Again, I think the idea of pagan there is still in there. Yet, and also, there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha, the prophet. Yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman, the Syrian. Now, Luke points to these two stories in the Old Testament that were miraculous healings, where people in Israel were excluded, probably because of their lack of faith, in favor of these two people that did have faith. Naaman had faith, this widow in Zarephath had faith and believed when Elisha came and said, hey, I need some bread, and the woman gave him bread, even though she was running out and that whole story there in Elisha. Same thing with Naaman. Naaman came into Israel and the king of Israel says, hey, Naaman, you're coming to me and asking for this cure. You're asking for a war because you're asking for a miracle. And someone says, hey, go see Elisha. And Elisha healed him of his leprosy. They didn't have faith in Israel. These pagan peoples came in. So I think I think John still has this idea in mind as he points to these stories here in his gospel of John. Because he says this in chapter 5, starting in verse 1. It says, sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for the Feast of the Jews. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the sheep gate, a pool, which in Arabic is called Bethesda, which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked them, do you want to get well? I can't imagine the guy, duh. No, sir, the invalid replied. I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me. Then Jesus said to him, get up, pick up your mat, and walk. At once, the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. Now, whenever I read this story, there's one question that always pops into my mind. Well, there's many questions, but one main question pops into mind. What about the other people there at the well? Why was this man healed and all these other people that were blind and lame and paralyzed not cured? I mean, we'd read no other miracles about this time. Now, we don't know much about this pool at Bethesda. In fact, it wasn't until the 19th century where the archaeologists actually found the pool and say, hey, this is the one with the five colonnades around that's just described as John. People think, oh, this thought this story was at first false because it was miraculous and the water stirring. In fact, different translations actually have in there some older translations of that people added in there. Said, hey, this pool was one of these magic pools that when the bubble angel came down and stirred the waters, it would cause people to be cured. We don't know much about it, whether there were actual healings or if there was psychosomatic healings or some of these false healings, imagined healings. We're not sure. But apparently it was the place to be if you were sick, if you had some injuries. And you had to wait until special things happened to the water, whether gases come up and bubbled it up or maybe an angel did come down. Again, we don't know much about it. But people believe these kind of things. You could always argue that, and you could always argue that if you weren't the first person in the pool, then maybe I didn't get there in time, or maybe the bubble stopped or whatever, and I didn't get healed, and so that's the reason why I didn't. So it's a very unusual place. But the fact of the matter, there was many people there on that pool that day. And Jesus comes to this one person who had been there 38 years. Now, that's a long time to wait for healing. And I think this also shows how determined and desperate this man was to be healed. I mean, he was there every day. In fact, if you continue reading the story, which we don't have the time to do this morning, we'll learn that this healing took place on a Sabbath, on a Saturday, that So he had to get there himself. He couldn't be carried by other people. That was work, and he couldn't do any work on the Sabbath, and that's what they get complaining with Jesus about later on, that he's healing on Sabbath. Again, we don't have time for that. But he had to get to that pool himself that day to be seen by him. And the only way he could do this by crawling there himself. He was paralyzed. He couldn't. He had to do it on his hands and crawl himself there. He was that desperate for healing that maybe that day he would be able to get to their water first. Even on this holy day, hoping that it might be healed by the moving waters. And so when Jesus asked him, do you want to be well? You could almost hear this man scream, isn't that evident? Don't you see the scrapes on my hands because I had to crawl here this morning? Don't you see that I've been here for such a long time? Don't you see that I can't do this myself? I can hardly move myself. Someone beats me to the water every time. Don't you see this? Of course I want to be healed. Of course I've been doing this every day for 38 years. Why haven't I been healed? I don't want to live like this. I'm not fast enough. My disability prevents me. I've tried over and over and over and over. I've had my wits end, Lord. I've even crawled here this morning to be healed, and yet I am not. You can almost hear the desperation in his answer. And so when Jesus says, okay, get up, he's ready. He had longed for that day for so long, it didn't take him but a moment to jump on his feet. And he was healed because of his faith in Jesus. And this comes back to my first thought of reading these verses. Why was it just this one man that Jesus healed? Was it because he was the only one there at the Sabbath? I don't think so. I think other people would come there. Was it just because he was afflicted for so long that Jesus, okay, since you're the oldest one here, since you've been here the longest, you're the one I'm going to do. I don't think that's part of Jesus' plan either. Was there some connection with the number 38? There's interesting, I was reading one commentary where it says, oh yeah, the number 38 was the number of years the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness, 38 years. And so they were in their sins for 38 years, and then finally they believed God and entered the promised land. I don't know about that. I think it comes back to faith. You see, as Jesus looked around at all these people, he says, who has faith here that would believe when I told them that you're healed? Who would have the faith? Who has enough faith to believe and trust in me? And I think he looked around and says, I don't see many people here. I only see the one. That one there, that one, he has enough faith. Jesus can't heal without people believing and having faith in him. And so that's why I think John connected this story with his idea of Jesus not being accepted in his hometown because of the lack of faith. Like I said, one of the times that mentions in the gospel says he couldn't do many miracles there because of their lack of faith. I think the same thing is true here in this story. Other people around the pool did not trust Jesus to heal them. They wanted to do it on their own, right? That's why they were there at the pool. They're waiting for that bubbling. They weren't waiting for a messianic Jew to come and say, hey, I'm here to heal you. They wanted to do it themselves. But this man had all but given up. He was desperate for something more. And so when Jesus came, he literally jumped at the moment and jumped at the opportunity. And then I think about our faith. Will it take us 38 years to start believing in Jesus? Will it take us that long to trust in him, to put away the worldly things that won't heal us fully? Because we're all very sin-sick souls. And we all need to be healed. And Jesus is the only one that can do that. He's the only one who can bring us life to our dead bodies. Remember, John's mentioning these miracles to point to something deeper that Jesus is trying to teach us. That Jesus is our healer. He's the one that can heal us. Not just of our physical infirmities. He can heal our what's really important in our lives, our souls. He can turn these dead, dying life into new life, as we talked about a few weeks ago. Eternal life. Sure, he can touch our bodies and heal us. I know we've prayed many, I prayed even this morning that people that are sick would be healed by faith. But I think we need to pray more for the spiritual sickness of the people around us. In fact, I wasn't going to mention this morning, but I was watching the news this morning, and they were just saying that the spiritual makeup of our country is starting to level off. It had been falling. Christianity has been declining according to different polls, but now it's starting to level off according to the last couple of years now. More people are starting to believe in Jesus than had been. Having that faith, because we realize, hey, what is there in life? We're all sick. We cannot heal ourselves because of our sins. And Jesus wants to heal more than our bodies. He wants to heal our souls. And I think this is what this story is all about. It's about faith. The widow in Elijah's time had faith. Naaman had faith in Elisha's day. This lame man had faith in Jesus' day. And all of us need faith in this world to believe in Jesus. So I like how John brought this idea of having faith and how people in his hometown did not. You see, Jesus came to heal those who believe in him. And his people didn't in his hometown. Other people around the pool wouldn't believe in Jesus. And in fact, in Luke's gospel, when he talks about Jesus saying, hey, you guys, you know, people in Elijah's day and Elisha's day had faith. You guys don't, essentially, is what he's telling them there. In fact, they took it such a way that they wanted to stone Jesus at that moment there when Jesus says he was without honor. He says, hey, you guys don't have the faith that these pagans did in the Old Testament, i.e., you don't believe in me, i.e., you're not real Jews, essentially what it was saying there. You're not truly believing in God. And so they wanted to kill him because that was blasphemy. Hey, we're... It says he walked right through them there in Luke's passage. So do you have faith to trust in Jesus? Because Jesus is asking all of us this morning, do you want to be well? Do you want to get well? Do you want to have your heart cleansed and healed from the brokenness that comes from sin? Do you want me to come and change your life to give you new life, to new vitality, new wellness? Or are you just going to go on the familiar passage, familiar ways, and treat me with more contempt? Do you want that healing today? I would urge you to let that healer come and save your sin-sick soul and make you well. That is what God wants from us this morning.